Hello and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, JP Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and the Birth of the Russian Empire, and Episode 49, Go and Take Kiev. The death of Yuri Dolgoruki forced the people of Kiev to accept Izyaslav Davidovich as their ruler, despite their professed hatred for the kings of Chernihiv. Key to this was the fact that Rostislav Mstislavich, who could have been their preferred choice if he had thrown his hat in the ring, maintained his support for Izyaslav. Therefore, on 19th of May 1157, Izyaslav ascended the throne of Kiev without opposition. In Suzdalia, the people of Rostov, Vladimir, and Suzdal acclaimed Yuri's eldest living son, Andrei, as his successor. Andrei was known as Bogolubsky, God-lover. This was not actually a reference to his religiosity. Rather, he built a residence called Bogolubova just outside Vladimir, on a site where he claimed to have had a vision of the Theotokos, or Mother of God. He commissioned an icon of the Theotokos, which became known as one of the miracle-working icons of Russia, and founded a church and a monastery. It was as a result of this vision that the capital of Suzdalia was transferred to Vladimir. Yuri's death also meant that the people of Novgorod, who, as we have already seen, liked to switch their allegiance to whoever they thought was the strongest, expelled Mstislav Yurievich and invited Sviatoslav, son of Rostislav Mstislavich of Smolensk, to rule instead. Once he was established in Kiev, Izyaslav moved to shore up Rostislav's support by providing his brother Vladimir with a new domain. If you recall from last time, Vladimir had been forced out of Vladimir and Volhynia and was therefore without his own lands. The target was Turov. Yuri Dolgoruki had appointed his sons to a ring of towns around Kiev, but as the tradition was that Kiev lands were no one's patrimony, they were unable to hold them after his death. Boris, who had been in Turov, had been forced out by Yuri Yaroslavich, a descendant of the Izyaslav to whom Yaroslav the Wise had given Turov as his patrimony, but who Rostislav and the rest of the Mstislavichi had declared had lost his right to rule the town as his father had not ruled. A large alliance marched out with troops from across southern Rus and Smolensk. However, the people of Turov fought valiantly for Yuri, and when a plague struck the attackers' horses, Yuri declared that it was evidence that God was on his side. Izyaslav was forced to withdraw without fulfilling his promise to give Vladimir a new domain. Izyaslav's fatal blunder was his support for Ivan Belyadnik, the pretender to the throne of Galicia we discussed in the last episode. While Izyaslav had been the ruler of Chernihiv, his support for Belyadnik had been a minor irritation, but now that he was the ruler of Kiev, Belyadnik became a rival that Yaroslav Osmomysil had to take seriously. Yaroslav secured the support of the Mstislavichi in neighbouring Volhynia. Once again, the chronicle fails to mention why they switched their support from Izyaslav, so we are left to guess that the failure to take Turov for Vladimir had undermined Izyaslav's position with the Mstislavichi. Izyaslav thought that he was still the head of the strongest alliance in Rus. He persuaded some of the Galician boyars who had previously supported Ivan Beletnik to once again invite him to take the throne, and then declared war on Yaroslav Osmomysil. Unfortunately, he had misread the situation. Before he could move, the combined forces of Yaroslav Osmomysil, Mstislav Chizyoslavich, and Vladimir Mstislavich attacked Kiev. His own cousin, Sviatoslav Olgovich, now ruling in Chernihiv, refused to come to his defense. His Turkic allies, Birindey and Torki from Parossia and Palovsi from the steppe, switched their allegiance to Mstislav Izyoslavich. The people of Kiev had no use for an Olgovich, who was no longer the strongest ruler in Rus, and they withdrew their support. The armies met outside Belgorod on 22nd of December 1158, fighting to a disastrous defeat for Izyoslav. He fled the field of battle and revenged himself on his cousin by pillaging the lands of the Olgovichi as his army retreated. The result was that he became an outcast in his own family. He had held Kiev for less than 2 years. Yaroslav Osmomysil, Mstislav Izyoslavich, and Vladimir Mstislavich all declined the opportunity to claim Kiev for themselves. The military defeat of Izyoslav Davidovich did not provide sufficient legitimacy in the face of Rostislav's superior genealogical claim. Rostislav was currently the senior prince of both the Mstislavichi and the wider Monomashichi families, giving him the right to rule through two lines of succession. Against him, Izyoslav Davidovich could attempt to reclaim Kiev, or Sviatoslav and Yaroslav, the sons of Vsevolod Olgovich, could present their claim based on their father having ruled in Kiev. Meanwhile, the people of Kiev made their support for Rostislav clear. Rostislav Mstislavich arrived in Kiev on 12th of April 1159. In May, he met with Sviatoslav Olgovich at Moravisk, and they concluded a pact in which Sviatoslav supported Rostislav's claim to Kiev, and Rostislav supported Sviatoslav retaining Chernihiv instead of returning it to Izyoslav Davidovich. Rostislav appeared to have an unassailable position. He had the full support of the Mstislavichi and of Yaroslav Osmomysil in Galicia, the allegiance of the Torki, Birindey, and Palovsi allies, and the support of the Olgovichi. Izyoslav, however, was not ready to just roll over. He wanted Chernihiv back. He went to the Palovsi in the steppe with Ivan Beletnik. If you recall from last episode, when things got too hot for Ivan in Chernihiv, he had spent some time in the steppe with the non-allied Palovtsi raiding Galician shipping. The pair found support and attacked Sviatoslav Olgovich's home city of Putivl, most likely intending to take it and then exchange it for Chernihiv. When this attempt failed, he decided to attack Rostislav's Smolensk domains. His Palovsi raided towns across the Smolensk lands, taking tens of thousands of captives to sell into slavery. This also failed to extract concessions from Rostislav. Izyoslav had one place left to turn, a ruler who has so far been absent from these power plays, Andrei Bogolyubsky. Izyoslav sent messengers to Andrei, proposing that his nephew, Sviatoslav Vladimirovich, marry Andrei's daughter. The other part of the deal being, of course, Andrei providing Izyoslav with military support. Despite having been standing off to the side since he took the throne, it seems like André shared his father's interest in influencing the affairs of the rest of Rus. And right now, he wanted to undermine the Mstislavichi, particularly in Novgorod, where Rostislav had placed his son Sviatoslav. While pledging to support Izyaslav's attempts to regain Kiev, Andrei also announced that he planned to rule Novgorod, warning its citizens that he would take it by force if he had to. Although the alliance did not bear any immediate fruit, there were signs of the usual cracks beginning to appear in Rus. These people just can't stay friends for more than 5 minutes. In the winter of 1159, the Volinia Mstislavichi attacked Yuri Yaroslavich in Turov, once again trying to seize the city for Vladimir Mstislavich. A short siege ended in failure, and they were forced to go home empty-handed. 1160 opened with the people of Novgorod once more causing trouble for their leaders, this time complaining to Rostislav about having to support both Sviatoslav and another son of Rostislav, David, who was living in Novi Torg. Sviatoslav conceded the point and sent David to join their brother Roman in Smolensk. But then he found out that the townspeople were conspiring against him personally. He appealed to their conscience, reminding them that they had kissed the cross to swear to Rostislav that Sviatoslav would rule them for life, but they seized him and imprisoned him in Ladoga. When Rostislav received word, he ordered the Novgorodians in Kiev be rounded up and thrown into a pit. So many captives were stuffed into the pit that 14 of them suffocated to death overnight. The chronicle tells us that Rostislav grieved over this, and he had the survivors spread out among several towns. Meanwhile, the people of Novgorod asked Andrei Bogolyubsky to give them one of his sons. He sent his brother, Mstislav, instead. This did not suit Novgorod, as Mstislav had already ruled there and been rejected by the people, so they refused to admit him. Andrei sent his nephew, Mstislav Rostislavich, instead. Sviatoslav escaped to Smolensk. Still hopeful of recovering his position, Izyaslav managed to win Sviatoslav Olgovich's support by promising him that he could remain in Chernihiv when Izyaslav took Kiev. The rest of the Olgovichi fell into line behind him as well, so he began gathering his troops. They assembled at Pereyaslavl with the Polovtsi and asked Gleb Yurievich to join them. Gleb, maybe somewhat surprisingly given Andrei's position, refused. After a 2-week standoff that failed to persuade him, Izyaslav set off to meet Rostislav. Rostislav had heard that he was at Pereyaslavl with his armies, and used the delay caused by Gleb to gather his own forces. When Izyaslav learned that Rostislav was marching towards him with superior numbers, he abandoned the field. But that was not the end of it. Maneuvers continued, and on 8th of February 1161, Izyaslav finally succeeded in catching Rostislav by surprise and forcing him to run away to Belgorod. Izyaslav took Kiev, but with Rostislav so near, he clearly could not claim to control it. He pursued Rostislav to Belgorod and put the city under siege. We rather get the impression that Izyaslav was not the greatest of military commanders, and in this case, his inability to make any impression on Belgorod allowed Mstislav Izyaslavich to arrive from Vladimir in Volinia, leading reinforcements from Yaroslav Osmomysil, the Berendei, Kovil, Torki, and Pechenegs, another of Bogolyubsky's brothers, Vasilko, and a couple of minor rulers. The people of Kiev provided Izyaslav with no support, and his own soldiers started slipping away. Mstislav Izyaslavich had driven him out of Kiev for the second time. Rostislav and Mstislav pursued Izyaslav as he fled. The chronicle tells us that they found him hiding in a pine woods by the lakes on 6th of March 1161. Their soldiers attacked him and killed him. Rostislav returned to Kiev and Mstislav returned to Vladimir in Volhynia. I think it's quite interesting how rare this kind of incident seems to be in the narrative. We are three generations into near-continuous warfare between the rival families, cousins and brothers, but how many times have you heard that one pretender ran another to ground and killed them? It seems that, like, outright killing your rivals was not part of the game. Izyaslav's death put a stick in the wheel of Andrei's plans to extend Suzdalia's influence over the rest of Rus. He was forced to pull back from Novgorod, while Rostislav's position there was strengthened. Mstislav Rostislavich was recalled to Suzdalia, and his place was taken by Sviatoslav. Inside Suzdalia, however, it was a different story. Andrei was actively building his power in a way that we have not yet seen in Rus. In the same year of 1161, he expelled his brothers, Mstislav and Vasilko, and his nephews, Mstislav and Yaropolk, from their domains, as well as depriving some of his father's leading officials of the domains that they had been rewarded with. Only his brothers, with possessions outside of Suzdalia, were unscathed. Mstislav and Vasilko were shipped off to Constantinople with their Byzantine mother, where the emperor treated them generously. According to the chronicle, Andrei's aim was to become the sole unchallenged authority in Suzdalia, an autocrat. And that is what he achieved. No one in Suzdalia was able to dispute his power. We might contrast him to Mstislav Izyaslavich in Vladimir and Volhynia, who clearly saw himself as the leader of the Mstislavichi. But there were so many Mstislavichi, their domains were fragmented, and the ones who were not also Izyaslavichi only acknowledged his authority when it was convenient to them. While Suzdalia remained less developed than the Kievan heartland, Andrei's consolidation of power dramatically increased his strength in relation to the fractured and quarrelling rulers of the rest of Rus. Mstislav Izyaslavich's ambitions received another setback when Rostislav made peace with Yuri Yaroslavich of Turov and agreed to protect him. That meant that the Volhynians had to abandon their attacks and look elsewhere for a domain for Vladimir Mstislavich. Vladimir Mstislavich decided to solve the issue himself by seizing Slutsk, a town north of Turov. This stirred up a different hornet's nest, as Slutsk belonged to the Olgovichi, and Rostislav had a pact with Sviatoslav Olgovich. Rostislav therefore sent his son, Rurik, and several other princes of the Olgovichi and Polotsk to deal with Vladimir, who gave in without a fight. Instead, he went to Rostislav in Kiev, and Rostislav gave him Trepol and some smaller towns. After several years demanding a major domain, he was now forced to settle for a provincial corner of the Kiev lands. According to the chronicle, 1161 also saw a breakdown in the relationship between Rostislav and Mstislav Izyaslavich, although the chronicle once again does not tell us why. Mstislav tried to get Vladimir Andreevich in Perestroytnitsa to join him against Rostislav, but he refused, which thwarted any plans Mstislav might have had for the time being. The entry for 1162 probably resolves the problem of what had caused them to fall out. We are told that Rostislav made peace with Mstislav and returned to him some towns that he had taken and reallocated to other allies, including Torchesk, Belgorod, and Kanev. These were Kievan towns, and the chronicle does not tell us when or why Rostislav gave them to Mstislav. The kings of Kiev usually gave the surrounding towns, especially Belgorod, to their immediate family, and Rostislav is the first we hear giving them to his allies, which reduced his own holdings. In early 1164, Sviatoslav Olgovich died and was succeeded by Sviatoslav Sevolodovich, who, in addition to being his nephew, was also Rostislav and Vladimir's nephew through his mother, Maria. This put him in a position to influence both the Olgovichi and the Monomashichi. Later, in 1164, after several years of mostly peace, other than the occasional raid, the Polovtsi crossed the Volga and began serious incursions into Rus once again. A Rus force went out to fight them under the leadership of someone called Vasilko Yaropolkovich. The Rus won the battle on the Ross River and took many captives, but in 1166 the Polovtsi set up camp at the Dnieper Rapids and began harrying the merchants travelling to Byzantium. The Polovtsi raids and Rus punitive expeditions continued with mixed success, and in the end, Rostislav was forced to assemble a proper army to take action. He gathered most of the Monomachs, including Mstislav Izyaslavich and Gleb Yurievich, as well as a number of lesser rulers, assembling their forces at Kaniv. The threat of this army held the Polovtsi at bay, and the merchants were able to complete their journey for this navigation season. There was no battle and no resolution. The conflict would continue to escalate. Towards the end of 1166, Rostislav decided to travel to Novgorod to visit his son Sviatoslav because, the chronicles say, the townspeople were once again causing trouble. He visited his daughter in the Chernihiv lands and his son Roman in Smolensk. On the upper reaches of the Lovat, he stopped because he was feeling unwell and sent word to Sviatoslav to meet him in Veliki Lugi. Sviatoslav and the prominent people of Novgorod came to him and pledged loyalty to him and Sviatoslav, and Rostislav set off back to Kiev. On 14th of March 1167, somewhere between Smolensk and Kiev, he died. He was buried next to his father in the monastery of St. Fyodor. Rostislav successfully established the ruling family of Smolensk, which would remain in power for another century, and kept it more consolidated than their cousins, the Mstislavichi. However, he achieved this by allocating his sons patrimonial domains in the Kiev lands, avoiding the fragmentation of Smolensk, but directly violating the testimony of Yaroslav that all his predecessors had followed. This would weaken Kiev. He was accepted as the senior member of the wider House of Monomach, and therefore his rule faced no serious challenges. Outside of a few disputes, he generally held the loyalty of the other rulers. However, we cannot say that he left Rus any stronger than he found it, and to add to the rivalries between the ruling families, we now have a growing threat from the steppe once again. Following Rostislav's death, the two paths of succession that he had united, the one favoured by Yuri Dolgoruki and the one favoured by the Mstislavichi, now led to his younger brother, Vladimir Mstislavich of Dorogobuzh. However, instead, the always ambitious Mstislav Izyaslavich of Vladimir and Volhynia, the city he had taken from Vladimir Mstislavich, once more usurped his uncle. The Mstislavichi generally supported the move, and the people of Kiev favoured Mstislav over Vladimir, who was suspected of harbouring Olgovichi sympathies since he had attempted to defend Igor against the mob. So, Vladimir Mstislavich joined the Kievans, Rurik and David Rostislavich, in inviting Mstislav to take Kiev. Mstislav sent word to his nephew, Veselko Yaropolchich, to hold Kiev for him, which he did. While Veselko was waiting for Mstislav to arrive, he found out that Vladimir Mstislavich, Vladimir Andreevich, Yaroslav Izyaslavich, and Rostislav's sons had already distributed domains to each other and kissed the cross to seal their alliance. Mstislav paused his march to Kiev to summon Yaroslav Osmomysil, the Poles, the Vsevolodovichi, Berendei Torki, Pechenegs, and Czerny Kobluki. He arrived in Kiev at the head of an army and immediately called a council of war. Meanwhile, Vladimir Mstislavich had occupied the nearby Vyshgorod. Mstislav marched on Vyshgorod with overwhelming force, and Vladimir and Rurik and David Rostislavich came out to negotiate a settlement. Agreement was reached on the allocation of domains, and they all kissed the cross. Mstislav Izyaslavich ascended the throne of his father and grandfather in Kiev on 19th of May, 1167. But Vladimir Mstislavich was not, in fact, reconciled to Mstislav's rule in Kiev. He began plotting against him almost immediately. His first attempt got nowhere. David Rostislavich got wind of it and reported it to Kiev, and Vladimir was forced to claim that he was being falsely accused of treachery and declare his loyalty all over again. Mstislav rewarded him with Katelnitsa, a town in the west of the Kievan land. But before long, he was plotting again. He tried to get his Druzhina involved, but they refused. So he went to the Berendei. He claimed that Vladimir Andreevich, Yaroslav Izyaslavich, and David Rostislavich were with him. But when the Berendei saw that he turned up alone, they suspected that they were being deceived and attacked him. Vladimir was wounded and fled home towards Dorogobuzh. He could not reach it because Vladimir Andreevich blocked the bridge across the Gorina and denied him passage. He had one option left. He sent word to Andrei Bogolyubsky in Suzdal, who told him that he would be safe in Ryazan. By now, you will not be surprised to learn that the change of king in Kiev also resulted in turmoil in Novgorod. The leading citizens of Novgorod called a secret vechi, where they decided to depose Sviatoslav Rostislavich. Sviatoslav got wind of the plot and fled to Velikiye Luki, from whence he sent word that he had decided he no longer wanted to rule Novgorod. The people of Novgorod sent word to Mstislav, asking that he send his son to rule them. Meanwhile, Sviatoslav made his way to Andrei Bogolyubsky on the Volga. Abandoning his previous opposition, Andrei provided Sviatoslav with troops, which he used to burn the Novgorod town of Novi Torg, while his brothers, Roman and Mstislav, raided Velikiye Luki. Bogolyubsky gathered more troops from Polotsk and Smolensk. Bogolyubsky gathered more troops from Polotsk and Smolensk and established a blockade around the Novgorod lands to prevent any messengers from reaching Mstislav. He was not quite successful, as one messenger did manage to sneak through. Sviatoslav and his brothers led a force of troops from Suzdal, Smolensk, and Polotsk against the Novgorodians at Russa on the Palist River. The battle was inconclusive, and Sviatoslav's troops continued to pillage the lands. We've seen several cases now where the people of Novgorod have immediately switched allegiance to whoever the new ruler of Kiev is and demanded a new ruler be sent to them. This time we have a new development in that the existing ruling family, the Rostislavichi, decide that they will impose their continuing rule by force. The chronicle does not tell us why Bogolyubsky decided to get involved, given that he has previously objected to Sviatoslav ruling Novgorod, so we have to assume that he is in an alliance with his neighbours in Smolensk. Allowing Mstislav to establish control over Novgorod would give him a foothold in the northeast, while keeping him out would maintain a balance of forces against the Izyaslavichi in the south. For the time being, Mstislav had limited options to deal with Novgorod. His place in Kiev was secure, since Vladimir had been his only challenger, but he had a more pressing issue, the continuing Polovtsi raids. Despite supposed peace treaties, entire villages were being abducted and sold into slavery, and there was major disruption to the southern trade routes. So he summoned the other rulers and their forces, and they were all quite willing to join the campaign. Rurik Rostislavich led his own and his brother David's men. Mstislav's brothers, Yaroslav and Yaropolk, came. Even Bogolyubsky's brothers, Gleb and Mikhalko, turned up. The Olgovichi came, and so did many of the minor rulers. The army set out on the 2nd of March. They reached the Polovtsi at their camps on the Ugla and Sneporod. The Polovtsi had seen them coming and were fleeing, but the Rus ran them down. Many Rus prisoners were recovered, and booty was taken. This was the first victory against the steppe by a combined Rus army, since Mstislav Vladimirovich had driven the Polovtsi back across the Volga in 1129. It should have been a triumph, but Mstislav managed to spoil his victory. He sent his own men to raid the Polovtsi camp at night without the troops of the other rulers, depriving them of the booty that they had counted on. This meant that, rather than the victory making him even more secure in Kiev, he had infuriated and offended his allies, who now began plotting against him. The distrust was fed by boyars spreading baseless rumours against Mstislav. They told David Rostislavich that Mstislav was plotting to take him and his brother captive and seize their domains. Mstislav also refused to reward Vladimir Andreevich with additional towns, which increased his disgruntlement. On the 14th of April, 1168, Mstislav decided to appoint his eldest son, Roman, to Novgorod. This further antagonized almost everyone, as the rulers of Rus were coming to see him as someone who grabbed everything for himself and failed to reward his allies. The Rostislavichi, who were not abandoning their brother's claim to Novgorod, were ready to break with Mstislav entirely. Andrei Bogolyubsky needed no encouragement, and by the end of the year he had formed an alliance of the malcontents. With the onset of winter, Bogolyubsky ordered his son, Mstislav, to lead an army of Monomakh rulers and troops to attack Mstislav Izyaslavich in Kiev. Forces from Rostov, Vladimir, Suzdal, and Bielorozera were joined by Vsevolod Yuryevich and Mstislav Rostislavich, back from their exile in Byzantium. Gleb Yuryevich from Pereyaslavl, Roman Rostislavich from Smolensk, Rurik Rostislavich from Vruchy, David Rostislavich with the men of Vyshgorod, Vladimir Andreevich, who was the only one from Volhynia, and Oleg and Igor Sviatoslavich from the Ogovichi. They were joined along the way by more troops from Polotsk, Murom, and Ryazan. The only Monomashichi still supporting Mstislav was Mikhalko Yuryevich. Mstislav sent him to Novgorod to reinforce Roman. The Smolensk forces found out that he was on his way and intercepted and captured him. While Andrei gathered his coalition and dispatched a huge army against Kiev, Mstislav Izyaslavich was having trouble finding anyone other than the people of Kiev willing to stand with him. Only his brother Yaroslav answered the call. The Torki and the Birindei sat the fight out, waiting to see the results. His other supposed allies, Vladimir Mstislavich, Yaroslav Osmomysl, the rulers of Turov and Chernihiv, stayed at home. Meanwhile, Andrei was deep in heavy negotiations. He was working from a position of strength. Suzdalia was not fragmented among quarrelling cousins, which made him individually the strongest of Rus rulers. The other rulers already agreed with him that Mstislav Izyaslavich had to be driven out of Kiev. Most importantly, since Vladimir Mstislavich had failed to take Kiev and was now an exile without a domain, Andrei, through his father Yuri Dolgoruki, had the senior claim to Kiev by lateral succession, with priority over Mstislav Izyaslavich. He therefore had the might and the right. His allies agreed to accept Mstislav Andreevich as the commander-in-chief and to follow Andrei's plan. According to the chroniclers, the people of Kiev defended their city valiantly, but Mstislav Izyaslavich's druzhiniki saw the writing on the wall and told him that they could not hold. He fled with his brother Yaroslav to Vladimir in Volhynia. On the 12th of March, 1169, Mstislav entered the city. The siege had lasted only 3 days. But there was no immediate move to claim the throne. Instead, the attackers ran wild, pillaging the city, massacring the townspeople, looting the monasteries and churches. The reason was that Bogolyubsky had another plan. He did not want the throne of Kiev. What he wanted was for the other rulers of Rus to acknowledge that Kiev was his to give to whom he pleased, and that Vladimir on the Klyazma was now the chief city of Rus. He did not even want to visit Kiev. He stayed in Suzdalia and sent his son to perform the mission for him. The sack of Kiev, a shocking and unprecedented event for contemporaries, was to drive the point home. Mstislav Andreevich appointed his uncle Gleb to rule in Kiev. Ostensibly, this was in keeping with the rules of succession. Gleb was the next eldest after Andrei, and his father had ruled in Kiev. By the strict lateral succession that Dolgoruki had asserted, all of his sons had a superior claim to rule in Kiev than Mstislav Izyaslavich. since the Rus had arrived in Kiev 300 years ago. This was the first time its primacy had been challenged, since Sviatoslav the Brave had briefly declared that he was moving to Pereyaslavets on the Danube and left his son Yaropolk to take care of Kiev. The scarcity of sources from this period means that we are left guessing about some things. Was the sack of Kiev revenge for the townspeople killing Yuri Dolgoruki? Were the soldiers of Suzdal and Smolensk settling scores from regional rivalries? Did Andrei order the sack and looting to undermine Kiev's cultural and commercial power and boost Suzdalia? We can only say for sure that they definitely attacked the city itself, not just Mstislav Izyaslavich, who had already run away. The sacking of Kiev has quite naturally been seen as a watershed in the history of Rus, but we must be careful not to read too much backwards into it from later events. It was certainly a major assertion of power by Suzdalia, a claim to preeminence. However, historians have extensively debated what the immediate result was. The prevailing view is that Kiev remained the leading political, cultural, and ecclesiastical city of Rus until the middle of the next century. But the old story that we have been following for 300 years, with the core rulers of Kiev, Chernihiv, and Pereyaslavl competing amongst themselves for the capital while dominating the peripheral domains, has shifted forever. Our story will be shifting too. We are not leaving Rus just yet, but our focus will be moving northeast, towards the beginnings of what will one day become Russia. And that makes this the perfect place to pause for your questions and answers in the next episode. I've already received some excellent questions, and if you have one you haven't asked yet, there's still a couple of days to get it in. Send it by email to hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com, through Twitter, Facebook, or the Spotify app, or the website. Beyond that, we will be looking at everyday life in Rus, catching up with developments in Volga Bulgaria, which has also grown and is now entering into a period of direct rivalry with the Rus on the Volga, introducing the Balts and the Baltic Crusades, before we return to the main narrative. But while the kings and princes of Rus squabble over Kiev, far away a man has been poisoned by a rival clan. His widow and small children are left destitute, cast out and reduced to subsisting on roots. Their survival is far from certain. Despite their poverty, one of the children begins to impress those they encounter through the sheer force of his personality, winning himself followers, rising through service and spending time in exile, before eventually recovering his father's position, and then more. His mother called him Temujin. He will call himself Chinggis. The people of Rus have no idea what is just over the horizon. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.